Godspeed with Carol Hollenbeck, Sundays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Godspeed Institute, an enlightening and positive forum exploring the world's religions and spiritual belief systems as an on-air classroom. In an effort to help people better understand each other, promote tolerance, and foster peace. I'm your host, Carol Hollenbeck. Our guest today is Llewellyn Vaughn Lee, Ph.D., of the Golden Sufi Center. He is a teacher in the Naqshbandi Sufi order, who are known as the Silent Sufis. He has specialized in the area of dream work, integrating the ancient Sufi approach to dreams with the insights of modern psychology, and more recently, in the emerging global consciousness of oneness. His books include The Return of the Feminine and the World Soul, Working with Oneness, Love is a Fire, the Sufi's Mystical Journey Home, Catching the Thread, Sufism, Dreamwork, and Jungian Psychology, and many more. Llewellyn, welcome to the Institute, and thank you so much for being with us today.
It's wonderful to be with you, Carol.
Now, before we get into the silent order to which you belong, perhaps we should begin with the larger topic of Sufism. Could you share with us what is Sufism?
Yes.
And go ahead.
What is Sufism? That's a very big question. I would say Sufism is the mysticism of the heart. Every mystical path is a way to have a direct inner experience of God, truth, or reality, call it what you will. And Sufism is a way to use love and the mystery of the human heart to have access to that inner truth. And it developed, I mean, some people say it is the ancient wisdom of the heart, the ancient mystical truth of the heart. But it developed under Islam in the Middle East and began then to spread across the Middle East and into India and beyond. But it is really a love mysticism, a way to access God within the heart. And my favorite definition of a Sufi, because Suf means wool, is you are a Sufi when your heart is as soft and as warm as wool. So it is for those who want to have a relationship with God as lover and beloved within the heart.
Thank you very much for that answer. So you say it emerged from Islam. Do we know what time frame and who might be some of its better known figures?
Well, in the early years of Islam, there were these mystics who were often ascetics and these powerful saints who lived their vision of God under the umbrella, if you like, of Islam. And for example, one of the very early Sufi saints was Rabia, a woman in the 8th century who was sold into slavery as a child, but had a very powerful relationship with God, and she was one of the first people to introduce the idea of love into this mysticism and to stress the importance of love. And she said very beautifully in one place that give the fruits of heaven to your friends, give the fruits of hell to your enemies, thou art enough for me. Stressing the importance of this direct relationship with God, this direct relationship in the heart. And then there were, of course, many other great mystics who followed in the early years of Islam. For example, Bayezid Bistami, a great 9th century Sufi who had these tremendous states of intoxication, of oneness with God. And in these states of intoxication and oneness, he would cry out, "Under my cloak there is only God." And this really brings this hallmark of oneness with God that is the very root of Sufi mysticism. In fact, there was another great Sufi saint called Al-Halaj who was known as the Prince of Love. And he was actually martyred for saying, "An al-Haq, I am the truth." This oneness between the human being and God that is, say, the core of this mystical truth. And he became known as the Prince of Lovers because he paid with blood this secret of love, this mystical secret of love, that within the heart we can discover that we are one with God. He said beautifully somewhere else, "I am he whom I love, he whom I love is me." So these are some of the early great saints in the Sufi tradition that just lived their mysticism. And then slowly what happened is over the centuries, orders or tariqas grew up around particular great Sufi saints, great Sufi figures. And one thinks of Rumi, who is, of course, very well known now in the West, the most popular poet, some people say, in the West, who spoke, he didn't write anything down himself, he just spoke these utterances of divine love, these intoxicating states of love. And it is interesting how it has touched us in the West so deeply that we must have a hunger for this divine love, not just the passionate romantic love, but something deeper, something more primal, something that belongs to the soul that Rumi calls out to so many people today.
Yes, that's very true. There's a timelessness and an incredible power in the beauty of his images. And it seems that in the mystical tradition, those kind of symbols just transcend culture, geography, and other religious filters, perhaps. But that said, the image of the lover and the beloved also is in the Western tradition through the Old Testament and the Song of Songs, and of course,
very potent there. He brought me to his banqueting house. His banner over me was love. I always loved that.
Yes. Oh, yes. And of course, in the poetry of someone like Saint John of the Cross, who has. Partly a Muslim heritage.
Yes, I mean this is,
in Spain.
Yes, I mean this was because, of course, in Andalusia, in Spain, there were many great Sufis. One thinks of Ibn al-Arabi, who was one of the greatest Sufis, who was known as the Sheikh of Sheikhs, who had tremendous visions and a deep, deep spiritual understanding. And one of his central ideas, he was born in Andalusia and then traveled across the Middle East to Mecca and to Baghdad and Damascus, and was the oneness of being. He had this great experience and articulated the Sufi belief that everything is one, everything is God, and to live from that place. And it's, of course, an experience of love within the heart. In the heart, you see how everything is one. Everything is an expression of God. And that is one of the foundations of Sufi mysticism, this deep understanding that comes from experience, not from books, because, of course, the difference between...
Yes.
In mysticism, it comes from your own experience, and you may write it and articulate it, but it is a lived experience, and this experience of oneness is one of the cornerstones of Sufism.
Now, how are you drawn into Sufi practice?
Well, I have, like many people, I have my own personal journey. When I was 16, I had what they call a spiritual awakening, actually, not through Sufism, through Zen Buddhism. And I read a particular Zen saying, the wild geese do not intend to cast their reflection. The water has no mind to receive their image. And it like turned on a light inside of me. I was an English student at boarding school with no knowledge of spirituality whatsoever. And suddenly this light went on inside of me and I started to meditate. I started to have inner experiences that took me beyond the world that I knew, into a deeper interior world. And then gradually I realized I needed to find a meditation teacher, and I met some friends when I was 19, and one evening they took me to a talk on the esoteric dimension of mathematics. And sitting in front of me was a old lady with white hair tied up in a bun, and she was a simple old lady, and I was introduced to her after the talk, and she had these piercing, piercing blue eyes that went right through me. And she became my teacher. Her name was Irina Tweedy. She was a Russian, and she'd just come back, Russian woman, and she'd just come back from India studying with a great Sufi master in India. And we used to meet, just half a dozen of us, in a small room in North London beside the train tracks. And I just looked in her eyes, and I knew that she knew. It's difficult to articulate because I was 19. I knew very little about mysticism. This was the early 70s. There weren't many books around or bookstores or anything like that. And I looked into her eyes and I knew that she knew, and I wanted what she knew. I wanted it more than I had wanted anything in my life before. Mm. And so I sat with her and sat with her and sat with her. And she trained me in this particular Sufi tradition that's known as the Naqshbandi Sufi tradition. We're known as silent Sufis because we practice a silent meditation of the heart, and our practices are done in silence. There are other Sufi traditions, for example, like Rumi's Mevlevi order, where they use music. They use the beautiful lament of the reed, the Ney flute, and dance. They use dance. And other Sufi orders, they do this vocal zikr, the vocal chanting of the name of God. Powerful, very intoxicating. But the particular order to which I belong, the Naqshbandi order, they're known as the silent Sufis. And we practice a silent meditation of the heart, and we do a silent repetition of the name of God. And interestingly, we also have a very strong psychological element that has been there since the very, very early days, and also the use of dream work. Bahauddin, who lived in the 14th century, he was renowned as an interpreter of dreams. And psychological work and dream work has always been part of this Sufi tradition. And part of my work was to kind of bring this traditional understanding of psychology and dream work into the 20th or 21st, I suppose we now are, century, Western understanding.
Llewellyn, can we get a little deeper into that, particularly how dream work is worked with or utilized, and also the psychology, because today we're living in a culture in which many would consider psychology or psychiatry as part of something that is pathologizing much of our life and for all ages at this point in the West. So can we explore a little bit how it works otherwise and can be utilized as part of a holistic approach to health and spiritual growth?
Yes, I mean, you see, real spiritual life is a process of inner transformation. Something within you, within your psyche, within your soul begins to change. And there needs to be some understanding of this process. It's very, very mysterious. This, you sit in meditation, you do a breathing practice, and slowly your whole inner self begins to change. And in fact, my teacher, Irina Tweedy, before she went to India to study with her teacher, she'd read the works of Carl Jung. And she was amazed to discover that this Indian guru, who knew nothing of Jung, his process of spiritual training was very similar to Carl Jung's process of individuation. In fact, she said, when she came back, she said, "I went for instructions in yoga. I hoped for spiritual teachings. But what he did was to force me to face the darkness within myself, and it almost killed me." And so one needs a framework to understand this process. And what she discovered and I worked on later was Carl Jung had this psychological model based on alchemy, based on this Western tradition of inner transformation that has a spiritual center, that has a spiritual core. It's not just about ego development, but it is rooted in the self, in the spiritual dimension of ourselves. So it became a very valuable model to help understand what is going on within oneself. For example, she mentions darkness. One of the initial experiences you have on the path is you are forced to confront your own inner darkness, what Carl Jung called the shadow. It appears in dreams, for example, as an unknown man or woman, often haunting you or aggressive towards you or out to get you, a man with a knife running after you. And you have to face these despised, rejected, unacknowledged parts of yourself. It's, of course, a journey towards wholeness, towards integration, what Jung finally called individuation. But there is a beautiful saying by one of Jung's followers, Yolande Jacobi, who said, "Individuation takes you to the entrance to the house of God." And this is where psychology and mysticism part ways, because the psychological work prepares you. If you have a very fractured psyche, you can't go deep within yourself because you get torn apart by the forces that exist there. Within us, within the human psyche, within the soul, there are very powerful forces. Jung called some of them archetypes. And you need to have a certain balance, a certain container in order to go deep within yourself. Otherwise, you get torn apart and can end up very, very unbalanced. And so individuation psychological work prepares you, takes you to the entrance to the house of God. But then there comes a time when you really, for example, in Sufism, you begin to experience states of love, states of intoxication, states of bliss, states of nearness with God. The Sufis talk a lot about nearness with God. And this can be the sweetness within the heart, a tenderness within the heart. You are with your beloved. It is very, very intoxicating. It is a beautiful, beautiful experience. And you begin to experience this overwhelming love. And that is when you, in a way, go deeper within yourself, deeper into the mystery of the heart. Because the human heart is quite extraordinary. We have a very surface understanding of the human heart, but mysticism, in particular Sufism, has developed a very detailed understanding of the human heart and what they call the chambers within the heart, these places of tremendous love, of oneness, of bliss, and deeper and deeper and deeper, which is the relationship with God that takes place within the heart. So psychological work is a very important preparatory stage for these inner mystical experiences, which otherwise could be completely overwhelming.
Thank you very much for that answer, Llewellyn. We're living at a time right now where we believe that the world is sort of shifting now from the head, as it were, to the heart, from the mental obsessions we have with intellect and achievement to a calling of a life lived, not without that, but with all these strengths lived through the heart, and helping us in our decisions and our living together as human beings on the planet. I find it interesting, Irene's journey, I think probably speaks to a lot of people who want to reach out for meditation for peace and are surprised that it becomes a journey into the darkness that could kill you.
You know, nothing is more but, tumultuous than mysticism. I mean, it is the most tumultuous, passionate, demanding love affair one can ever have, and a human love affair pales in comparison to what says in the Old Testament, thy God is a jealous God. And this is, one great Sufi said, there has to be blood. It has to be lived with passion, with intensity, with tremendous feeling. And then, in a way, you break through this veneer of what we think we are as a human being into this great secret that humanity carries within us, which Sufis have been known as the people of the secret, because they carry the secret of this deep connection we have with God, this primal oneness that is lived within the heart and experiences a quality of love, as divine love, which takes all of you, but then what else is there to do? And as you say, there is a need at this moment in this planet, there's a calling, actually, as if the planet itself is calling for us to open our hearts and to make a connection with life, with each other, based upon oneness, based upon love, based upon empathy, based upon we rather than me, because the me in our culture is destroying this world, and we need somehow to grow out of this addiction with our little selves, with our ego selves, into this greater dimension of what it means to be a human being, because the Sufis say we are made in the image of God. And if you ever have a chance to glimpse a human being as they really are, they are magnificent. I was only seen it once in my life. I was young, I was in my early 20s, and I saw a group of school children walking down the road, and I was shown them as they really are, and how in the center of each of these school children there was like this blazing sun, so full of light I could hardly look. And these were just ordinary school children going for an outing to the park, and I was shown what we really look like in our divine nature. And maybe the cycle of life is changing away from materialism, away from this addiction that we have, calling us back to recognize this divine nature that we are. And maybe it is time for mystics to come out of the closet. That is certainly my experience, that there is a, you know, mystics are by their very nature very solitary, private people. And maybe there is a calling for life that we need to know these mystical secrets of oneness. We need to know these mystical secrets of the heart. That life needs this ancient wisdom that belongs to humanity, which is carried within the heart. It's one of the great mysteries Ibn al-Arabi, as I mentioned before, is a great Sufi. He said the great mystery of the human being is all this wisdom and knowledge and understanding was placed within us and then veiled from us. And maybe it's time to begin to bring together science and mysticism to understand how the inner and the outer worlds work together. At least that's where I have been called a little bit, because we live in very demanding times.
Yes, yes. And at the same time, they're very, very demanding and incredibly challenging, and there's tremendous suffering, but at the same time, there's also just the same amount of opportunity and a chance for people to connect through positive use of, you know, some technology as we are right now.
Yes, and spiritual technology. There is, you know, there are different forms of technology, and mysticism has, or real spirituality has spiritual technology that can wake us up, that can, again, reveal the secrets that we have within us, the wisdom, the deep understanding that is our mystical spiritual heritage. And what is interesting is how these techniques in the last 30 years have been given to the West and used and also misused, sadly, but that's another story, by people in the West.
Yes. And could we do a whole other show on misuse of spiritual technology? How long did you get to study with Irene?
Well, one doesn't really study, because mysticism is a process of losing oneself rather than finding anything. And I wasn't allowed to read any books for the first 10 years until I had to study the works of Carl Jung. But I met her when I was 19, and when I was 26 and was married, then I inherited some money and I bought a house, and she lived downstairs and my wife and young children lived upstairs, and we had a meditation group downstairs, and that continued until 10 years later, when my wife and I and my children were sent to America to bring this particular tradition to America. So she died in 99, and she was completely part of our lives for all of that time. So,
now,
it was a lived experience.
I'm sorry?
It was a lived experience rather than studying. She was a very passionate woman who, yeah, in her later years, discovered this mystical truth and was called to teach it and bring it to the West. And,
now, there is a succession in the order to which you belong, almost like an apostolic succession. And she was the, I guess, the previous, what would you call it, a sheikh?
Yes, she was, she actually never called herself a sheikh or sheikha. She called herself a deputy. And this has to do with a very esoteric aspect of Sufism that is not so well understood in the West, which has to do with what is called transmission. It's also present in Tibetan Buddhism. That to wake up a human being, to take them on the journey back to God, a certain energy is needed. That a human being on their own does not have enough energy to make this step from ego consciousness into the divine consciousness that exists within us. And in Sufism, this is called the transmission that comes down through the succession from teacher to disciple, or teacher to teacher to teacher to teacher. And she brought this particular transmission from India at the death of her teacher. And it is an energy that is given from heart to heart that has the capacity to wake up and then spiritually nourish the disciple, the one who wants to give themselves to this particular Sufi path or Sufi tradition. And it's in this particular tradition, it's known as rabita, this bond between teacher and disciple, which is a bond of love, a bond within the heart. And traditionally, the succession goes back through all the generations, right back to the Prophet, peace be upon him.
Now, how do you apply these principles in daily life?
Well, you live them. I mean, you live life from your heart. You live life as a relationship to God, because the Sufis say, wheresoever you turn, there is the face of God. And you live life as a love affair, because that is... it is not something separate from life. It is, in a way, the very foundation of one's life. The very purpose of one's life is to become closer to God. And you try to see the beloved or see God in the outer world, in people, in experiences, for example, the Sufi says about experiences, all experiences are sweet if you taste them with care. Everything comes from God if you learn how to live it. And also to go deeper within the heart in your own inner practice. So it is very much a lived, it's not a monastic order, for example. People have families and jobs and work in the world, and that's part of our spiritual practice. One particular practice in the Naqshbandi order we do is called solitude in the crowd, outwardly to be with the people, inwardly to be with God. It's slightly similar to the Shaker expression, hands to work and hearts to God, which I always loved.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a way of living that relationship with God, with every breath in the end, because what else does one want to do if once you have tasted this truth of what it means to be with God? In a way, that is the passion, that is the meaning of one's life, is to live this love affair. There's a beautiful Sufi saying, which I love, which is, there are servants among my servants who love me, and I love them, and they look towards me, and I look towards them.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Sufi is often known as the servant. We are the servants of God. And God is sometimes known as the servant of his servants. It's a beautiful expression.
But yes, thank you. Thank you very much for that answer. As you say, people are married, have kids, have bills on their mind, worries on their mind, concerned about, commuting to work and getting the tasks done of the day. How can this transformation of heart in daily life transform those experiences and how we relate to others?
Well, first of all, you relate to others through love as much as possible. And you realize we are all part of this living oneness, this human family, this ecological family, this oneness. Of course, you get angry when you get a speeding ticket. You know, this is human nature. One great Sufi, said, strive to be a true human being, one who knows love, one who knows pain, be the bowl of wine passed from hand to hand. And all I can say is it can be done. It is a mystical tradition in which people have been living in the world for hundreds and hundreds of years and making the journey back to God as part of it. I don't say it's easy. I think in this contemporary culture it is almost incredibly difficult because it demands so much. It's not like you are just a potter and your father was a potter and his father was a potter, and the choices you have to make, the daily demands. We live in an incredibly materialistic society, and but it can be done because the heart is as big as the universe, the secrets of the heart. And it can contain anything. And you can, if you have a difficult boss, you put your boss in your heart. You learn to love your boss. Everything can be contained with love because everything belongs to God. This is one of the things we have forgotten. We have forgotten that everything belongs to God. And of course, love is this substance of God that is, through love, you can have the most direct relationship. It is one of the forgotten secrets that everything in creation is part of God. It is an expression of God. And once you begin to have some mystical experiences, and you see that, you see how, of course, human beings, you can see the divine more visibly in human beings, or in nature. But everything, this is what Ibn al-Arabi said, oneness of being, everything is God. And we have forgotten that, and we live in a very poor culture as a result, because what else can give real meaning or substance to our lives except the divine that is the source of everything?
Yes, and I think, with the amount of fear that we have culturally, it manifests in so many ways in which we turn away from each other. Even people, I spent a lot of time in New York City, and I recall being on the train, the subway, and now and again a homeless person would come on the train, and immediately there'd be this radius that, went out around that person as people moved away.
Yeah.
And I remember looking at this one gentleman in the face, and he wanted to sing a song to someone, and he wound up singing Casey Wood Waltz with a Strawberry Blonde, and the band played on to me in the subway car in New York, and it turned out to be one of the most beloved memories I have commuting.
That's very beautiful.
just by looking at someone that you know, others turned away from.
Yes, we are very frightened of the unknown in this culture. It is strange, because we have so much images of security, and yet we are so anxious, so frightened. And of course, one thing on the mystical path is you have to face the unknown within yourself, which is usually much more terrible than any outer unknown.
Very good. Well, Llewellyn, we're halfway through the program. I'm going to stop her station ID for a moment, but hang on. You are listening to the Godspeed Institute live on the Progressive Radio Network. We're going to take a short break, and afterward we will return to our conversation with Llewellyn Vaughn Lee of the Golden Sufi Center. Let's spend a couple of minutes with Michael Franti. Stay with us.
Your best friends, because a best friend will never try to do you wrong. And don't fear your worst friends, because a worst friend's just the best friend that's done you wrong. And don't fear the night time, nah, because the monsters know that you're divine. The sunshine, 'cause everything's better in the summertime, summertime. And it's never too late to start the day over. It's never too late to pick up the phone and call me. It's never too late to lay your head down on my shoulders. It's never too late to come on home. The water, nah, 'cause you can swim inside you, within your skin. And don't fear your father, 'cause the father's just a boy without a friend. And don't fear to walk slow, nah. Don't be a horse race, be a marathon. The long road.
Oh, come on, yeah.
'Cause on the long road, you got a long time to sing a simple song. Sing along. And it's never too late to start the day over. It's never too late. Pick up the phone. Pick up the phone and call. It's never too late to lay your head down on my shoulders. It's never too late.
Welcome back to the Godspeed Institute. I'm your host, Carol Hallenbeck. We're speaking with author and teacher Llewellyn Vaughn Lee of the Golden Sufi Center. Now, in this part of the program, I'd like to focus a little more on the topic of oneness, and I realize it's a little esoteric to discuss, but I'd like to start with a quote, I think, from one of your books, Working with Oneness, and it goes like this. Oneness is very simple. Everything is included and allowed to live according to its true nature. This is the secret that is being revealed, the opportunity that is offered. How we make use of this opportunity depends upon the degree of our participation, how much we are prepared to give ourselves to the work that needs to be done, to the freedom that needs to be lived. Can we discuss the concept of oneness and your book as well, Llewellyn?
Yes. I mean, oneness, as I say, is very simple because at its root, everything is one. We talk now about holistic medicine that includes the whole human being. And, of course, now we are being faced with a global ecological disaster that requires us, I mean, not just requires us, it's an understatement, but calls to us, that vitally needs us to recognize we're part of one living ecosystem, because people say we're coming into the sixth mass extinction and the mass extinction of ocean species, and life is dying because we live in this image of separation, that we are separate from the planet, we are separate from each other. And this is where I felt that the mystic has a vital contribution to make, because, as I say, at the root of most mystical experiences, in a way, whether Sufism or Christian, is this experience of oneness, the direct experience of oneness. And life now needs that consciousness of oneness, and to help us to understand how to live together in a way that can sustain us, that can nourish us, rather than cut ourselves off from the source, cut ourselves off from our environment, cut ourselves off from each other. And so in the year 2000, I started in meditation to be given these teachings about oneness. Before then, I'd just written about Sufism, and then I was given a whole series of teachings about the spiritual dimension of oneness and how to bring those into everyday life and how to live from this place. And since then, I've been very glad to see that the idea of unity consciousness or global consciousness or consciousness of oneness has become more part of the, in a way, mainstream vocabulary, because at that time it wasn't. But it is very basic to life, because we are one human family living on one planet, and you have this iconic moment when the astronaut looked back and saw the planet as a whole, as one living being or one living object without borders. And that is the symbol that we have been given, but we have to learn how to live it.
Thank you for that. It's so important that you mentioned that moment too. I remember as a child listening. There was a little 45 record that was put out about the lunar landing. That was the discussion between the astronauts in Houston. And I remember listening to it over and over and over again, and I didn't. It just seemed tremendously important to me, even if I didn't really understand yet what the significance of that was. It called out. Now, ecologically, yes, you mentioned the disaster. We seem to respond to disaster as human beings. It seems a catalyst. You know, we see the oneness that occurred, for example, around 9/11.
Yes.
It's almost as though we need to be shocked out of some sort of our illusion or our dream of what's around us, and then whoever we are inside just instinctively reaches out in love.
Yes, I think the question is whether we can stay with that or whether we contract back, because what happened in 9/11 was very moving. I mean, spiritually, to see this outpouring of love and prayers from all over the world towards America, I found it incredibly deep. When I went into meditation, I could feel it. This, you know, for weeks afterwards, this outpouring of love. And it was a tremendous moment, because so rarely has the whole world, their hearts, their prayers opened towards one country like that from this terrible tragedy. And then there came the contraction back into fear. Then there came the contraction back into the ego. And then, in a way, those prayers faded away, because this is the opposite of prayer. It is the simple difference between me and we. And when the me, the ego, contracts back into ourselves in fear and anxiety and then defensiveness, while the oneness, the we, opens us to being together, but also many other possibilities. When you say one, it opens, it touches the heart. We are all one. And it is to go beyond, yes, there is this moment of grace. There's always a moment of grace in which something is opened. It can be from a disaster, from the Gulf oil spill was a disaster, but it also reminded us how we are all contributing to this oil spill in our use of oil. We were all contributing to that, but it's whether we can stay with that rather than contract back into the ego self. And sadly, we have a culture that, in a way, that focuses on me, on the ego self, on the greed, on the values of the ego, rather than us together, not just. I mean, for example, I find it interesting this whole idea of sustainability. When people talk about sustainability, what do they mean? Who or what is being sustained?
Yes.
Is it our lifestyle that is being sustained, or the wild places on the planet that are being sustained, or the fishes in the ocean that are being sustained?
Right.
And, these are very important questions, which often we overlook in our rush to support our own ego self, our values, what we want.
And yes. It's interesting that you mentioned the Sufi master who basically said there has to be blood.
Yes.
There has to be sacrifice.
Yes.
That day, for example, the people who were reaching out to help others as the buildings were falling down in New York and who were caught under them themselves, you know, they were great martyrs.
Yes.
of love and of one human family. And after that, there was a rise and increase in religious services, basically across the board in America for months. After that, and then it just sort of started to dwindle down again, as you say, and people perhaps got lulled into, well, okay, we're safe now. I don't need that so much anymore.
There's a very nice Sufi story of somebody who was going to visit a Sufi master he didn't know, and he went to the town, and he went to the master's house, and his wife was there, and he said, is the master at home? And she said, no, he's actually attending a funeral. And he asked, how will I recognize the master? And she said, well, it's very simple. When you see the people going to the funeral, everybody has a light over their head. And when you see the people coming back from the funeral, only the master has a light over his head. And he said, because everybody going to the funeral remembers God, remembers their mortality. And so they have this light of divine remembrance over their head. But coming back from the funeral, everybody is turned back towards the affairs of the life, towards the affairs of the world. But the master still remembers God. And it is whether we can keep this remembrance, not just in the face of disaster, but as a shared experience that we are part of one human family that at its deepest root is sacred, and the whole world is sacred. And that is something we seem to have lost in the last 200 or 300 years, this deep understanding of the sacredness of creation that really is a feminine mystery, actually, the sacredness of creation and belongs to the goddess. But that's another topic, but
that you've perhaps hit the real, you know, the trick of this, the real heart of this, which is how do we continue to maintain this, you know, whether there is a no conflagration or tragedy or just our daily life together. How do we keep this in the forefront? I guess it doesn't even matter what our tradition is.
No, it's all the same, because the Sufi says, in the name of he who has no name, but who appears by whatever name you call him. You can call him Jesus, he appears as Jesus. It is the one truth, it is the living presence of God. And that's why, you know, mystics, when they come together, it doesn't matter what faith they follow, because it is the one being, it is the one presence, it is the one truth that has touched them all. And this is what matters. And
go ahead.
And how to bring that truth back into daily life, because we are a secular society that has lost contact with the sacred. And I, for example, firmly believe that if we had a sacred relationship to the earth, we wouldn't rape and pillage it as we are doing now. We wouldn't treat it in the way we are treating it. There would be a different consciousness. And it is interesting that our culture has separated the world. God got sent into heaven. The earth became this mechanical place whose laws we could understand and hopefully master, but we lost touch with what is sacred, what is most precious. I remember when my teacher cooked me a meal, the first meal she ever cooked me, and it was cooked with so much love, I could taste the love. I'd never experienced anything like that in my life. And the love in the food nourished me in a way that I'd never been nourished before. And this is something so foundational to life, that we can live in a sacred manner, and our soul is nourished, not just our body. And we are souls as much as we are bodies, or more souls than bodies, but we have forgotten it. And we are paying a price for our forgetfulness in all of the addictions people are drawn to, because if your soul is nourished, you don't need to be addicted. It is this lack of real nourishment, and then it comes because we have lost connection with the sacred, with the fact that life is precious, life needs to be respected, life needs to be made holy. And it is not about me, it is about life as a whole.
Now, I imagine when people hear the word, as we talk about oneness and perhaps unity, that there might be a question of, well, does that mean we're all the same, or we're supposed to be the same, or believe the same things? How would you address that?
Well, the beauty
regarding
of
oneness?
Beauty of it is, if you have real experiences of oneness, everything is valued in its unique nature, in its true nature. Oneness is actually the opposite of sameness, because you look at the whole of creation. They say the great artist never paints the same picture twice. No two snowflakes are the same. And this is oneness. The whole of creation is an extraordinary tableau of oneness in which everything is unique, everything is individual. I find it interesting in the West we have made this journey towards individuality, which is a wonderful journey with like the rights of the individual and things like that, and the uniqueness of each person, which is very important because we each have our own dreams, we each have our own destiny, we each have our own the note of our own soul to play in the great orchestra of life. But we have become caught in the grip of the ego that says, what is important is me, and we now need to turn back towards oneness so we can play this unique note of our own soul, of our own self in the great symphony of life, and then hear this beautiful music, which is the music of the one living being that is our planet, that, for example, has a soul that the ancients understood as the anima mundi, the soul of the world, and reclaim our spiritual heritage. It doesn't matter what religion or what path you follow. It is all one because everything is one, but we need to reclaim it. And it is both we need to reclaim it and also the earth itself needs us to reclaim it. The earth is calling to us. The earth is dying and it is calling to us. Don't do this to me. Don't do this to me. Learn to revere me. Learn to respect me. I am your mother. I am the sacred soil out of which you have come. And we need to honor that call and learn. We need to grow up, stop behaving like adolescents, and grow up and learn how to work together with the land, with each other, with the oneness that is present in every moment. And this oneness will allow us to live our own unique nature, because that is the nature of God.
Now, do you think people are afraid to live their true nature, if it means stepping out of that car in traffic, the car that's helping to hurt the planet, and reevaluating everything, and what does it mean then tomorrow? What does it mean with next month's mortgage payment? What does it mean?
It's a very, very good question. And you mentioned earlier to do with 9/11 sacrifice. And what nobody seems to be dare to say, or at least what no politician is dare to say, is in order to live in a sustainable world, what do we have to give up? Because it is obvious that with all the people in China, in India, moving into the middle class, this materialistic culture is not sustainable. Apparently it needs 1.5 worlds to provide the material for us to support it. So what do we have to sacrifice? What do we have to give up? What are we prepared to give up? And sadly, we have been sold this materialistic way of life, that stuff will make you happy, stuff will fulfill you. It never does, of course. But
it never has.
It never has, but there are enormous vested interests in keeping us caught in this materialistic nightmare rather than dream, if you like. And how can we free ourselves? How can we free ourselves from the grip of this very seductive pull into materialism and really to say, you know, what do we really need to live the dignity of ourselves? What is really important? And what was interesting is recently there was this tornado disaster in Justin, I think is the town.
Yes.
And listening to people afterwards who had lost everything, but their child or their partner was safe, they said, all that stuff doesn't matter. All that matters is the love. And I was so deeply touched by that because I said, that's true. That is how it really is. But we have become addicted to the stuff. And what do we have to give up? What do we really need? That is the question we need to ask ourselves, and ask it soon, because the world is dying at the moment because we are polluting it and destroying it so much with our greed, with our materialism.
Yes, thank you for that answer. Let's talk for a moment about the discord in the world. Where would you say religious violence and conflict come from?
Look, there is so much misunderstanding. It's like the image of the Tower of Babel. There is so much misunderstanding between people. And I would rather than look at the discord seems to be part of human nature. But let's focus instead on the deeper oneness which we have to reclaim. It is easy to look at discord and get caught in discord and try to solve the problems from one party or another party. I personally don't think it can be solved like that. I think it can only be solved from the deeper understanding we are all one and that we need to work together to save this planet. And yes, there will always be people who want to fight it out with their brother, the story of Cain and Abel. It's part of our myth. But we are moving into a different time now. If we can grasp that, if we can live that, where it's not about me and mine, and I am right and you are wrong, but we are all together living in this planet. We have to learn to get along. And if you talk to really, you know, mystics who understand that, they see that, they live it. We're all breathing the same air, and it's now very polluted air.
Right.
And we have to rise above these differences and not to work towards protecting ourselves and our values and our beliefs, but how can we be together? Because we are one human race on one planet that is dying. And we can shuffle the deck chairs on the Titanic as much as we want, but it doesn't help.
Yes. Now, Llewellyn, after last week's show, a listener asked us why we do not ask the, quote, tough questions, confronting our guest about...
Oh, sure. Ask a tough question. I'm very happy with a tough question.
Oh, no, because this, what you're saying is very pertinent, because we, you know, the format of our program is very deliberate.
Mm-hmm.
We invite everyone in all traditions to speak openly about their beliefs. And we think, and it's all welcome and respected, and we think that is the tough route. It's easy to get sucked into the political arguments where everyone else is in the media,
right.
Basically.
I agree.
It's easy to say, how can you say that when, this happened and that's happening with your, how can you say you believe that when, you know, there's violence? We think the hard thing is actually to listen to each other deeply, which is the root of the word obedience, by the way. It's to listen to give ear to.
Yes.
And to hear from everyone, because the violence and the discord perhaps is happening because people aren't talking to each other or listening to each other or connecting on that level. Well, that gives the opportunity to realize we are one. This person is me, and I am that person, the same as Thomas Merton realized at an intersection in Kentucky.
Yes. No, that's...
One day, I am all these people. We're not enemies.
No.
We are one family.
Yeah.
So what do you say about proceeding in this manner in the future?
You know, we live at a time of tremendous crisis. And you can either get caught up in the crisis or you can go to the root of the crisis. And for me, as a mystic, the root of the crisis is that we have separated ourselves from what is sacred, from what really matters. And we are getting caught in the surface events. Rather than, Rumi says, return to the root of the root of your real self. And if you return to that root, you do find this simple truth that we are one. And it's not a truth that belongs to any religion, to any creed. It is the Australian Aborigines understood it in their relationship to their land. They couldn't imagine living without it in the same way as a Buddhist mystic understands it. In the same way as a Christian understands it. It is this deep oneness that is at the core of our being. So return to that, live from there, breathe from there, and act from there. Because then you are in harmony with the forces of creation. When I wrote this book, Working with Oneness, for example, there is a way to work with oneness. For example, oneness is organic rather than hierarchical. There are no hierarchical power structures in oneness. It is an organic way to work, to live, to be together, in which you see the connections, not the separateness. And we need to learn how to work with oneness, how to live with oneness, to see how we are connected, how we are part of this whole web of life that is living, that is breathing, that is also dying, that needs our attention. So it is, yes, and you need to learn to listen, because as a mystic, listening is very, very important. You have to learn to listen to God. You have to learn to listen to life. You have to learn to listen to your dreams. You have to learn to listen to your heart. You have to learn to be receptive, because the mystic, by its very nature, knows nothing. We are empty. We are just here, like Rumi says, a blank sheet of paper for the beloved to write on. And we have to learn to go back to this core of our being, the core of ourselves, which is what you do in any crisis, is you go back to what is most important. That's why I loved it when these people said they lost their trailer homes, they lost everything, but love was present. Why not return to love? Why not return to the heart and see what can grow out of there? Because this world is a miracle, you know. It belongs to God, not to humanity, and we've forgotten that. We think it's our world. It's never been our world. It was never our world. It will never be our world. It belongs to God. It is a miracle how it came together, how there is just enough oxygen to support life. It is a miracle. And if we return it to the divine, then maybe the divine can work a miracle again and help this world to come alive in a new way that is not self-destructive, that supports the integrity of all of life, the uniqueness of all of life, whether a butterfly, a bee, a human being, whatever aspect of life you are. I'm a mystic. I believe in God. I believe in the grace of God. That is, in a way, what I return to.
Yes. And as we come to the end of the program, which has been a wonderful exchange, I want to thank you for, what words do you have for today's 16-year-old just awakening?
For today's 16-year-old, don't forget the mystery that is within you. You are not part of a materialistic culture. You are a sacred human being. Try to discover it and live from it. As Jung said, find the meaning and make the meaning your goal.
Thank you so much, Llewellyn. If people in the audience want to learn more about your work, can you please tell us where they can go, perhaps website information?
Yes, we have two websites. One is www.goldensufi.org, which has my Sufi teachings, and then another, workingwithoneness.org, which has all of the oneness teachings and also from other spiritual teachers. We also have a Facebook page, Working with Oneness. So those are the two areas of my work that people can access easily on the Internet.
Well, thank you so much for being with us on the Institute today. It's been a great pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you, Carol. Thank you so much for your questions and for the sharing that we have had between us.
Thank you very much. And thank you, listeners, for joining us for the Godspeed Institute today, where it's all about having faith in the 21st century. This show was recorded live on the Progressive Radio Network in New York City, engineered by Barry Dwyer, and produced by Michael Hallenbeck. If you would like to hear this or any of our previous shows again, or send it to someone, simply go to GodspeedInstitute.com, where you can find my books on spirituality and a library of others. Join us again as we continue to explore all the world's religions and spiritual belief systems. And if you'd like to send us a comment, please feel free to do so at office@GodspeedInstitute.com. We'd love to hear from you. Until next time, we wish you Godspeed on your journey.